Section number 8735.
Dr. Saxton, tape 4. You're now going to tell me about your part in the Battle of Harama.
Yes. It was a critical stage in the war when the attempt to direct assault on Madrid itself by Franco's forces had bogged down in the university city, where the international brigade had stiffened the resistance of the Republican armies in Madrid. And the international brigades were really at the height of their popularity. They stayed popular throughout, but first sprang into the public eye as they marched through Madrid to the front. And this gave a tremendous morale boost in spite of the small, relatively small numbers compared to the rest of the Spanish army, because they felt someone was coming to help them in their struggle.
Did you yourself take part in that march through Madrid?
No, it was too late for that. The assault on Madrid had started, you see, before I had got into the National Brigades. That's why we felt so isolated out in Aragon, where nothing was happening, and we knew this terrible battle was taking place around Madrid. Anyway, that had bogged down. There had been a tremendous loss of international brigaders in that battle. They were mainly the early arrivals. The British and the French came a bit later. The first international brigades were formed of people who were already exiles from their own countries, who were exiles from Germany, for instance. A lot of them were from Germany, from people who had had to flee from Hitler. They flocked to Spain and formed the 11th International Brigade, which is the first of the international brigades that were formed. And the 12th, I think, were mainly Slav people, who again were refugees of one kind or another from Poland and other very reactionary regimes that existed at that time. The 13th, I can't place them at the moment. The 14th was the French and Belgian one, which we got incorporated in. So we were about the 4th brigade that was formed, and it was only the first two, I think, that got into the battle for Madrid. So that battle had bogged down, and the insurgent, the fascist forces, were hoping, being unable to take by frontal assault, to take it by encirclement or by cutting off its vital food supply, which came up from Valencia on the Valencia to Madrid road. And so their next attack then, in this respect, with this object in mind, was to cut the Madrid-Valencia road. And in particular, there is this little river Jarama, which runs, I suppose, it must be a tributary, I imagine, of the Manzanares, the main river on which Madrid exists. This river was, as it were, the line of dividing the territory between Franco-controlled Spain and the Republican Spain. And this was the line which had to be defended and which was breached by the fascists, at least in the beginning. And we had to counterattack. And the Jarama battle, which we were concerned, was ready to defend this patch and drive the fascist forces back. General Walter was in charge of the international brigade units in that area. General Walter was a Pole who had a very difficult name, like Wasilewski or something of the sort, but who called himself for simplicity and possibly for disguise, I don't know. Walter. He later returned to his own country and became the home, or the home office, or whatever you would call it, a comparable thing, after the Second World War, and was ambushed and killed by some Polish werewolves, I believe they call themselves, some partisan, right-wing partisan unit. So I met General Walter once. He suffered from some chest complaint, but I saw him in passing. Now, in this battle for Jarama, we were sent as a medical unit. By this time, I had passed from the 14th Division and been incorporated at a higher level in the 14th Brigade and incorporated in the 35th Division. Now, the divisionalized hospital was a much bigger affair, and we were sent to a village on this Madrid-Valencia road, that's right, called Villarejo de Salvanes. Villarejo de Salvanes. Yes, got that right. And there I was sent with an advance party, together with my friend Dr. Alexander Hart, two of us and a chauffeur and some little transport. We sent up under cover of darkness, because there were planes about at that time. I was completely lost. I didn't know the geography of the place at all. I was just doctoring and going where I was sent. But nevertheless, we were sent with this, and we had a very hazardous journey because of the dark, more than anything, because we couldn't use lights and so on. We were very tired to start with. We'd been travelling for a long time to get there from a fairly restful place where we'd been near Madrid, on the safe side of Madrid. And so we arrived at Villarejo. The place, it was after midnight, I don't know what time it was, early hours of the morning, complete darkness, and there was this village. And we were supposed to do something about starting up a hospital. It all seemed a bit difficult to know where to start. But, however, nothing daunted, so to speak. We went and looked for the largest building we could find in the place. And we found the village club, village hall, village, I don't know what, administrative centre, village with everything in it. People met for drinks in it, people came to discuss village affairs in it, they had meetings and all the rest of the social activity. It was the one big place in the town. And so we went up to this place in complete darkness, and there was nobody about, and hammered on the door. And after a very long time, a voice was heard the other side of the door, "Who are you?" or something like this. And I went. One of the reasons I was sent was that I could speak a certain amount of Spanish by this time, because I had been working on that. Well, Dr. Hart was my senior in this matter. He was a captain. I was only a lieutenant by this time. And he was in charge of this party. And so he was telling me what to say. So he said, "Tell me to open up. Say, we've got to start a hospital here. It's a matter of expecting a lot of wounded from the Republican Army. And we have the authority of the Army to take the most suitable building and make a hospital." And so I explained all this through the door, and the man said, "Oh, well, I can't open before daylight," he said, "it's now." And Dr. Hart said, "Now look here," he said, "you tell this man he'll be arrested if he doesn't open up at once." So I couldn't think of a Spanish word for arrest. So I was searching for my mind, how can I sort of use some other word which would, well, the only thing I think of was shot. So I tell this chap, "Look here," I said, "if you don't open up, you're going to be shot." But you see, Dr. Hart, with his accurate knowledge of Spanish, of French, could get the gist of what I was saying in Spanish. And he was furious with the Americans, and he was shocked, you see. So we had a great altercation on our side of the door. He was telling me how it would spoil our relationship with all the local people if we threatened to shoot people who are our friends and our allies and for whom we were fighting. We told them they were going to be shot if they didn't do this, that, or the other. And he's like that, is Dr. Hart. I mean, he makes a mountain out of a molehill. Of course, it wasn't a molehill. He was quite right in a way. But to have this altercation and a long lecture outside the door at this crucial moment was terrible. Anyway, when this fellow had sort of taken the matter in a bit and realized that we meant business, he said, well, if you will get permission from the mayor, I will open up, he said. So anyway, he told us how to find the mayor, and so we went to the next street or something, and we interviewed the mayor, got him out of his bed and this, that and the other, and he immediately agreed that we should do so, and we went back. So we came to this great hall, and without any obvious proof of it, we told the chap, we said, look, the mayor says we can come in. So he opened up. And now we went in this great rambling building. It was quite a big building. And there's a sort of courtyard in the centre, with balconies all round and rooms opening off these balconies, great big halls and things. It was really quite good from our point of view. And so we sort of decided to start allocating rooms for different purposes. We took over the bar, where there was water supply and counters and things for our operating room. We decided we'd have two operating or three operating tables there. It's quite a big room. I don't know what, about 30 feet, some more than that, long. And as I say, with these bars and things conveniently placed. So that became our operating room. Then we went round the sides and we found an enormous sort of hall, which was a meeting place. So it seemed enormous. I don't know how big it was, but it was quite big. And lots of benches. It was full of benches for people sitting on. Just ordinary wooden benches. And we hadn't any beds. We knew we'd got mattresses. I tried to steal some beds on the way along from where we'd come from. I'd been forced to, from a hotel for our wounded, but I'd been forced by the military command to hand them back, which was rather annoying, because, I mean, we felt that the needs of the wounded were paramount, so to speak, and that we should seize these beds and take them with us. So we arrived, we only had mattresses, I knew, in the rear guard. We were, as I say, just going ahead and trying to prepare the way for the rest of the unit. But I decided that these benches, if put seat to seat, the backs on the outside and the seats meeting in the centre, would make something resembling a bed. And there were hundreds, or it seemed like hundreds, vast numbers of these benches. In fact, too many, more than we could use. And we went through this hall, turning all these benches seat to seat, and we made a sort of ward of about 20 or 30 beds to receive the mattresses, which we knew were coming the next day, or with daylight or whatever. And there were still masses of benches over, because when you put seats close one behind the other, there are too many if you try and make them into beds. And so we piled the rest of these benches out on the balcony, a great mass of benches, higgledy-piggledy all over the place, on this balcony. And then we went around and we found various other smaller rooms we made for sort of intensive treatment centres, you might call it, and for VIPs. That annoyed me somewhat. Dr. Hart, I mean, he'd had ideas about military setups and organizations. It would be important if you had wounded generals or something, or people who had to continue, even though they were wounded, communicating information and this, that, and the other, to have certain people who were VIPs put in smaller rooms where they could talk about matters of military importance or something. He had this sort of idea where conferences with patients could take place. I know it annoyed me from the sort of point of view of equality and all this sort of thing that there should be such things as VIPs at all at that stage. At any rate, Dr. Hart had a lot of good ideas as well as airy-fairy ideas. His head was mainly up in the clouds, and his feet was often rather too near the clouds too, but nevertheless he did think big and look ahead. He could see the later organisation of frontline hospitals and hospitals a bit further away, could do more important work that would take longer, and convalescent homes behind those and so on. He could sort of visualise organisationally in that way. But he was a very difficult person to work with, very difficult. He was a bit very argumentative and dogmatic but we got this place then allocated and a certain amount of preliminary organisation done and decided what facilities there might be available for staff and for resting and for feeding and this sort of thing. And then with daylight the rest of the lot gradually came along and started putting the equipment in. Well, by this time I hadn't any sleep for 48 hours and I was really feeling terrible. I just couldn't keep awake. I mean, you reach the stage when you feel I don't mind what happens. I've got to sleep. I just can't stay awake anymore. Not Hart, mind you. He was still rushing around, giving orders or making suggestions, arguing. I just couldn't stay awake anymore. What could I do with this? This bustle of people going all over the place, putting things here, fetching things there, asking questions, this, that, and the other. And I thought me of this great pile of higgledy-piggledy benches on the balcony there, which nobody wanted. They were just in the way. All just cast down without any care. And there were sort of spaces and nicks and niches between them. And I crawled in under these benches and worked my way right to the back where nobody could see me, and I went to sleep. I didn't care what happened. I just couldn't stay awake. And after I'd slept for a couple of hours or so, I could hear a voice. Saxton, Saxton, where the devil have you got to? Come along, come at once, you're needed. Where? I want to find so-and-so, and I've lost this, and what do we do with so-and-so? Where are you? Come here. Where are you, Saxton? Where is that? Where has he got to? All sort of going on, and just sort of creeping into my ears after I'd slept for a couple of hours. So I crawled out. I'd had my rest enough to keep going. So I crawled out and answered what questions I could, what he said and what he wanted to know. I don't know what it was now. and so we set up this hospital. Right. We had this one big ward, a few side wards, a few special rooms for sterilizing and for stores of equipment, that sort of thing, you know. And where did we do our triage? There were two of these big rooms. One was a ward and one was for reception of wounded. Well, we sort of did our triage, sorted out people who came in on stretchers. I think they were
did there. They soon start arriving?
Oh, very soon. Within 24 hours we were getting wounded coming in. A lot of these wounded, they were all kinds. I mean, all nationalities. We had a lot of British and American, yes. But we also had Spaniards, Germans, that I can remember. There's two nationalities. I'm sure there were several others. I could speak a bit of German, too, so I got along there. That was quite useful. Slavs, I couldn't talk any of their languages. And Central Europeans, various. not many outside the European continent except for the United States, though we had later on. Anyway, the wounded started pouring in during the next 24-48 hours, real large numbers, and I was working in triage, first aid, helping, dressing, preparing people for surgery, and so on. And we had an awful lot of cases of exsanguinated patients.
What does that mean?
Who had lost so much blood that they couldn't survive without transfusion. And at that moment, we'd been there a day or two and unable to cope with these terrible wounds where transfusion seems unnecessary, and we just couldn't find the donors. They were all working, and there was very little civilian population to draw on. In any case, they hadn't the facilities to deal with the situation of transfusion. When onto the scene, as it were, like a fairy godmother, came the Canadian doctor, well, appeared on the doorstep. Dr. Norman Bethune. Now, this Dr. Norman Bethune, he'd studied in Canada, he'd had tuberculosis, he'd, by his own will and determination, he'd got over this thing, not just through mental concentration there, but he was determined to get well and do everything possible to get well. He'd been put in a sanatorium to die. That was all they could do with people who had tuberculosis of the lung. The way he had it in those days. And it was just at the beginning of that time that new ideas had come forward of treating by collapsing the lung with artificial pneumothorax. And he insisted, against the advice of and will of the people in his sanatorium, he insisted on having them try this method on him, and it succeeded, and he recovered from this. He was very socially minded. He was a very individualistic person, but he had a love of ordinary people, shall we say, a feeling of dedication to treatment, and he was a very skilled man. He was a surgeon himself, and he would give his services free of charge, that sort of thing. He was a generous-minded man, but terribly individualistic, terribly determined to do what he thought was right and under all circumstances, even when he was wrong. an energy man, full of like a dynamo. And he'd come to offer his services to Republic in Spain. Where the idea came from exactly, I don't know, but the need was apparent for blood transfusion. So he collected together equipment, skilled people, one or two, and started the Madrid Blood Transfusion Institute. And there, with Spanish doctors too, and a small staff of Canadians, I don't think they were medical, but skilled in one way or another and could drive vans and this sort of thing, you know. He started this institute and recruited blood donors and got blood which could be stored in refrigerators, stored blood. And there he appeared at this little hospital in a pub, you might say, in Villarejo, with a refrigerator and stored blood. It was magnificent. Well, I was the only medically qualified person in our hospital who was not mixed up with major surgery. We had three surgeons there working all the time they could, just doing surgery. The medical students that we had with us were the anaesthetists, and then there were the nurses who were working all out. And I was not a surgeon, or minor surgery, of course I could manage, but I was not capable for major surgery. I just hadn't got it in me. That's it. I wasn't a major surgeon. I mean, I hadn't got the skill and knowledge, understanding, experience to do major surgery, abdominal surgery, or what have you, or major amputations. I had to do all the rest. And so I was the only person available. They said, Saxton, you must do the transfusion work. So I got down to seeing what Norman Bethune had to offer us, and I gladly took everything he could give or advise. And I think it was he who provided us with a refrigerator. I can't remember what power that worked off at that time. Later on I had one which I worked off, methylated spirit, I remember. But I think we may have had an electrical supply and it worked off electricity. I can't remember how it worked. But we had a refrigerator and he provided the blood from Madrid. And so, but my instrumentation was terrible. How was I to give this blood when I'd got it? Well, that's why... Well, never mind. Anyway, what I had, the only way I could give this blood, and my skill at transfusions wasn't that extensive. I had given one blood transfusion in my life at Bart's as a house surgeon. I had done a 3-month house job at Bart's, not as a surgeon actually, but I was doing a locum for a house surgeon. I was a house physician. just for 3 months in the outpatient department, that's all I'd done in hospital work. I had done a little bit of general practice for this, now here and there. I'd just given this one transfusion. I knew about blood groups and this sort of thing. I got that, fortunately, as a student, I got that well fixed in my mind, all about what was known then about blood groups. But the actual mechanics of giving blood, I had had this one experience, which was very fortunate I had that much. It was a great deal more than having none at all. And but my instruments were so primitive. So anyway, I rigged it up. I had a cannula, which by cutting down on a vein, I could insert into a vein. And this is what I had to do. And I had a long rubber tube and a funnel. So I delivered the blood into the patient by pouring it into a funnel, and it came down a tube and went through a cannula into the patient's vein. And it worked. It worked very well, but of course it was a bit tedious and troublesome, and sterilizing wasn't, well, too easy or even too perfect, but still we just had to wash it out and boil it up and do it again. And this is how I was transfusing our severely exsanguinated patients. I can remember one poor devil, I mean, he was bleeding out practically as fast as I was putting it in, though I didn't know, because he was bleeding in the lungs. I remember this poor devil, he felt so much better having had one transfusion, which I put, in fact, in this case, into his arm. I didn't often cut down. Usually one cuts down on the ankle, well, usually, one used to. So I gave him this one transfusion in one arm, and he felt so much better, but he could feel that he was, you know, going just the same. So he said, can I have another in this arm? Well, what can I do? I only had a very limited amount of blood and everyone, so many people needing it. He died, like so many others.